This is Calliope Writing Coach, the podcast about writing and publishing success from every angle. I'm Angie Fenimore, international best-selling author and writing coach.
And I'm Michael Sheen, author, platform designer, and marketing master. Episode 16, I Am Not a Serial Killer. Welcome, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Calliope Writing Coach podcast. I'm Michael Sheen. We've also got Angie Fenimore in the house. Welcome, Angie.
Good morning.
And our special guest today is Mr. Dan Wells. Welcome, Dan.
Hi. Well, thank you very much.
Dan Wells writes in a variety of genres, from dark humor to science fiction to supernatural thriller. Born in Utah, he spent his early years reading and writing. He is the author of the Partials series and the John Cleaver series. He has been nominated for both the Hugo and the Campbell Award and has won 2 Parsec Awards for his podcast, Writing Excuses. Now, Dan, we know you well enough to know that that bio is completely absent of a whole lot of things. Fill us in with the rest of the details.
That's a little bit old, yes. First of all, I guess most notably, the John Cleaver series, book one of that, has just been made into a movie. I guess I say just. It came out last year. It's been around. It's gone to a lot of festivals and won a lot of awards. So we're very happy with that. We're very proud of it. Also, I have a new science fiction series. After I finished Parcels, I started on a new one called Mirador. The first book is Blue Screen. And the second book in that series just came out in February, called Ones and Zeros.
Ones and Zeros. Yeah, I saw that.
So, and I have just released a standalone science fiction novel called Extreme Makeover that's about cloning and the beauty industry.
Mm.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
That looks really interesting.
So we had an opportunity to see your movie, loved it. It was very, very interesting, very indie, had a great feel to it. Were you on set for any of that? Were you able to participate, or did you just hand over the script and walk away?
I didn't do the script either. I just...
Okay, they just adopted your novel.
Yeah, so I, and most authors, in fact, don't have any creative control over the movies that are adapted from their works.
Yeah, we know. And
yeah.
We're well aware.
I had no official anything with the movie, but it was a small indie production, and because of that, the director was much more involved with me than most directors are.
Yeah.
And over the course of the 5.5 years that it took them to raise all the money to make the movie, we became very good friends. And so I got to read several drafts of the script. I got to provide a lot of input. And eventually, yes, did get to spend about 10 days on set. You know, movies are all filmed out of order and in odd ways and in odd places. Mm-hmm. I was there for the exterior snow shots, because it happened to snow right as I arrived. And so they said, hey, change the schedule. We're shooting all the outside snowy stuff right now. So anything that takes place in the middle of the night in the freezing cold, I was there for, shivering off camera.
Yeah, yeah. Great timing.
Well, you know, it's terrifying. I had a book that a movie... Edit. Just give me a second.
Okay. Derail.
I had a book that the guys who made Gods and Generals and Selena and I can't think of this third film they made that was a big deal. Gods and Generals. Geronimo.
Okay. So Angie's having kind of an off day. Cats Productions made Gettysburg, not Geronimo, as previously stated. Oh, and they also made the Milagro Beanfield War.
Yeah, they bought the film rights to a book I wrote. And let me tell you, I was so impossible to work with. They never made the film. And they didn't renew the option. So,
yeah, so there's
lesson. Yeah, I was terrified. They could do anything. They could do anything with it. It was just too scary for me.
So you've been up to a lot lately since I pulled the bio off of your website there. What's been going on? You just released another novel.
Yes. In fact, last year was crazy. Actually, in 2016, I put out 3 books, and then another one just last month in February. Mm-hmm. It's 2 months ago now.
Okay.
Which is a total of 4 books in a 12-month period, which is too many.
How did you do that?
We won't be doing that again.
Did you have some of those on back burner, or how in the world did you accomplish that?
Yeah, Extreme Makeover had been written a long time earlier, and then it just took a while to get it through the okay. wheels of publishing.
Okay.
So it all kind of just came out at that point. My plan for 2017 was to try to write 3 books,
mm-hmm.
and I might still do it. I might still write 3 books. Usually I only do 2. But I am not going to try to publish 3 books in a year again, because I don't think that I had enough time to adequately promote them all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I would
right,
think would
exactly. Exactly. There's a reason why the publishers like to have them come out one at a time, you know, because you do want to promote and then piggyback
yeah.
with the next one and promote, you know, and then the one that was released prior also gets more attention then as well.
Yeah, you don't want to eat your own audience, because they're all excited about one book and then you immediately say, no, stop thinking about that one.
Right.
Read this other one. I might be doing a non-genre book, and I don't want to talk too much about okay. it in case it doesn't happen at all.
Right.
But if I do, that one will almost certainly be under a pseudonym, and I feel like that I could promote pretty heavily concurrent with a different one,
mm-hmm.
because then the audiences are separate and they wouldn't be devouring each other.
Right, right. Well, and it's awfully ambitious as well. You know, how do you put out 3 books or 4 books in a year? How does that even happen?
Man, heck if I know. I rely heavily on the publishers to do their jobs, and for Good. The most part they have, and, yeah. and they've been awesome. It's just the author, him or herself, has to put in so much work to do promotion,
mm-hmm.
that I just don't think that it worked out. Like, the publishers can do their jobs and they can sell the books as best they can, but I think I need to, if I'm going to give it my best, I need to limit it to 2 books a year.
Right, right. Well, I would agree. And even 2 books is pretty ambitious, but what? Why are you looking at me like that?
I'm just looking at you to...
Okay, don't worry, Dan. We'll be editing this out. You need to move whatever is down there that you keep kicking. You got a sound thing going on. Here's what I want to know. I want to know about the movie. I want to know your experience of that. That really intrigues me.
The movie?
Yeah. I'm not a serial killer. How that was to turn that over to somebody else, to take your baby and turn that over to somebody else.
It was hard. It was harder than I expected. My attitude, my very vocal opinion on adaptations has always been that I want them to be new and different. You know, I have already read the book. I don't need to see a slavish recreation of something that I've already read, you know, that's why, and I know this is a heretical opinion in a lot of areas, I really didn't like most of the Harry Potter movies.
I know, right?
Because I felt like it was just same old thing that I, you know, I've already read this book. I don't need to see it exactly recreated in a different medium. Mm-hmm. They didn't add anything, except, in my opinion, for the third movie, which I thought was really cool and new because they were adapting it instead of just reproducing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been my attitude for a long time, and then that got sorely tested when I had to actually hand over my book and say, okay, make it your own thing. Don't just recreate what I did. And they did. They gave their own spin on it. You know, we got to see several artists' version of the story that I told and the characters that I created.
Mm-hmm.
And once I got over that hump, which was hard and which took several different things, I really am very happy with what they produced in the end. And there were a lot of big changes they made, like the ending is pretty significantly different.
Right.
And there are also little changes, like in the books, Brooke, the girl next door, is a blonde, and the actress that they hired has black hair. And I complained to the director about that and said, what are you doing?
Really?
She's not supposed to have black hair. And he said patiently, Dan, you idiot. That is the least important part of this performance and this character. Just watch how she acts, and she's brilliant. I mean, she does. I can't imagine anyone else doing that role now.
Mm-hmm.
So I just had to get over myself, and I think that they did a really phenomenal job with it.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. I would think that would be strange to see somebody else kind of take that and run with it, so to speak. What awards has it won?
The main awards that it keeps winning is, in Europe, they have what's called the Silver Moon Awards,
mm-hmm.
which, and the actual name of it is French, and I can't pronounce it. So I'm going to say the Silver Moon Awards, which is kind of a tiered system. So at each kind of individual fantastic film festival, they will give out a Silver Moon, which means best in show.
Okay.
And we won that in Spain, and I think we won another one somewhere else. I'm pretty sure we won one in Strasbourg. Anyway, the winners of the Silver Moon Awards go on to kind of an overall category, like there's a much bigger central fantastic film festival later that anyone who's won a Silver Moon is put into the running for the big fancy Silver Moon, which is like the best of the best. And so we're in the running for that. And I think that's really cool. That's more recognition than I kind of humbly expected to get. And it's just because the people working on this movie, Billy, the director, and all the actors and everyone working behind the scenes, they really did a great job with it. Another award that I have to mention, because I think it's wonderful, is Christopher Lloyd, who plays one of the two leads in the movie.
Right.
He won Best Supporting Actor for our movie in a horror award.
Really?
Specific to horror films.
Yeah.
And it was called the Horror Movie Podcast. They have a really impressive juried system with, like, you know, 30 film jurors from all kinds of different branches of the industry. And we won Best Supporting for Chris Lloyd, and we won Best Adapted Screenplay, which Billy and Christopher Hyde wrote based on the book. And one of the things they said in giving Chris that award was that it was the best performance of his career, which is saying a lot, because Christopher Lloyd's been around
for many
decades doing incredible work forever. And I agree. This is one of the first times that he's gotten to do a really solid dramatic role that wasn't campy and wasn't ridiculous.
He wasn't the comic relief.
Which is one of the things attracted him to our movie in the first place, is most of the time if someone's asking him to be a villain, it's because they want a ridiculous,
a kooky
kind of Judge Doom from Roger Rabbit kind of villain.
Yeah, yeah.
And he wanted to do ours because it was smaller and it was a real character, and he hit it out of the park. He did an incredible job with it.
Oh, he was terrifying. He was terrifying. Well, he did a great job.
I'm a Laura Fraser fan, you know, from Breaking Bad. And it took me a
Laura
little while.
Fraser, she's one I didn't get to meet, unfortunately, because she showed up for her scenes about, you know, the day after I left, unfortunately. But she's phenomenal as well. I think a lot of the supporting cast in the movie is great. I love Christina Baldwin, who plays Laura Fraser's sister in the movie, and Dee Noah, who plays the Christopher Lloyd's wife.
Mm.
Who I think in many ways is the emotional center of the whole movie. And she's incredible.
So how has the success of the movie affected your writing career?
Or this, and this, you know, point, have you seen a spike in book sales? And
I don't know yet. This is April now, and so this is when the royalty check comes, and that's when we'll find out. I know a lot of authors track their sales much more overtly than I do, and that's not something I have a lot of interest in, though I think my wife is going to start doing it because it drives her nuts to kind of be surprised by royalty checks every 6 months.
Yeah.
Anecdotally, I can say that it has brought me a lot more attention.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been on your show before, for example. But in terms of actual translation to sales and money, we'll just have to wait and see. My agent, I was talking to her this morning, and she's going to be in Bologna this weekend, which is a huge European agents kind of convention where they all get together and try to sell each other their stuff.
Right.
And she says she's already had a lot of interest in my books, driven in part, I think, by the great success the movie has had in Europe. So
yeah,
we'll have to see.
Yeah. Well, that's excellent. Let's talk about your podcast. You've been doing your own podcast for quite some time.
Yeah, we are at least 8, if not 9 years in now on Writing Excuses.
So, oh, wow. I didn't know it was that long.
Yeah. I was seeing that the first episode was May of 2009, I think.
2009. So that's 8 years, coming up on the 8-year anniversary.
Maybe 2008. Next. It's been a while.
No, I think you're right. I started Writing Excuses right before Serial Killer was published. And I remember both of those dates because it was also right before my son was born.
Mm-hmm.
And he's 8 years old, turning 9. So
yeah,
that's what's going to happen.
It's an amazing podcast. It's is it weekly that you produce an episode?
Yes. We record, at this point, about 4 times a year and get, you know, all of the episodes done and sent to an audio engineer, and mm-hmm. then he puts out one per week. Mm-hmm. They typically come out Sunday evening, although this week's came out this morning. So sometimes we miss our deadlines a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, we've been going on for 8 years now. It's me, Brandon Sanderson, Howard mm-hmm. Taylor, and Mary Robinette Kowal,
mm-hmm.
who joined us after the first few months because we realized that we needed somebody smarter than we were to make sure it worked. So we brought in Mary,
mm-hmm.
and she's been incredible.
So how has the podcast helped build your platform?
Well, that, you know, it's the single best promotional thing I've ever done, frankly.
Mm.
You know, someone like Brandon, who doesn't need the boost that the podcast gives him, he's doing it just because he's a great guy who wants to help people. The mm-hmm. rest of us are mercenary.
mm.
We're doing it because it's a fantastic way of getting our names out there. And, you know, helping people's a great thing to do on the side.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have been invited. I've been a guest of honor in 8 years I've been publishing. I've been guest of honor at a convention twice for my writing, 3 or 4 times for my podcasting. So it's definitely, I think, what I am known for,
mm-hmm.
even more so than my books.
Yeah. And do you find that being known on the podcast makes publishing that next novel any easier?
Not necessarily. In fact, I would say unequivocally no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, success doesn't always breed success. It breeds notoriety.
Right.
And so it is easier for me at this point to meet new editors mm-hmm. and to, you know, to impress the editors that I already have. But at the end of the day, it still comes down to, is this book good enough?
Right.
And, you know, even with 12 published books under my belt and a Hugo Award and all these other things, I still need to sell a book exactly the way everyone else does. I need
right.
to write it, and I need to give it to the editor and make sure that they like it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that there's any sense of, well, this isn't as good, but we'll publish it anyway because you're famous. You know, I'm sure at some level of fame that happens.
Yeah.
But
well, we've
it
seen
has
it
not
happen,
happened to
but
me.
You know, it doesn't go over well.
Yeah, I am glad that, you know, we are all as authors still being held to that standard because mm-hmm. I don't want to get to the point where I can put out a crappy book just because I'm famous. And I've read crappy just because you're famous books, and you can always tell, oh, you know, this one just didn't get edited as well as it should have.
Mm-hmm.
This one needed to bake a little longer.
Mm-hmm.
Yay yeah. for that not happening.
So, one of the things I like to find out is, what has been the biggest surprise that has come with your writing career?
Oh, man. Well, some of the things that surprise authors are, I mean, most of them are unpleasant, you know? Like, any author who becomes successful, who gets published, first of all, they're surprised by what we just talked about. They're surprised, I'm surprised, or was at the time, that it's still hard to sell a book.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of think, well, I'm in the door now. I'm never going to get out the door again. No, you still have to keep working, and you still have to, you know, have that feeling that you're breaking in over again
mm-hmm.
with every new book that you write. the bigger surprise for me, and in some ways an even less pleasant one, was how much business work I am doing instead of art. I kind of had this picture in my head that as a self-employed full-time author, I would just get to sit and write books all day. Mm. And I do a lot of that, but it's, you know, some days it's not even most of what I do. Some days I don't get to do it at all because in addition to being an author, I am a small business owner.
Exactly.
I have to do all of this financial work. I have to do promotional work. Mm-hmm. I have to, you know, do all of this peripheral stuff to keep the wheels turning so that I can, in stolen moments, go back and actually write.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm almost schizophrenic that way where, you know, if I'm in public, I'm presenting or I'm, you know, doing something public, you know, I'm on, right? Of course.
Yeah.
And I find that can be so exhausting. Take, you know, not in a bad way. It just takes a lot of energy. It's like running a marathon, right?
Yeah,
and then
right.
The creative, you know, process and sitting down to write, the way I write is I go down dark, deep for days. And, you know, that also takes so much. You know, and even interviewing people in the podcast, my experience of other authors is, it takes a lot to be a writer, you know, especially a successful one. There's no arriving where you're, you know, all of a sudden it's easy.
Yeah. I mean, that's something Victoria Schwab has been talking about all of last week, you know, and she's, you know, a multiple number one bestseller with all of this incredible stuff going on. And, you know, same as me, same as all of us, we still have to put in the work every time.
So have there been any pleasant surprises to becoming semi-famous in the writing world?
I mean, yes. There's things that you expect, but even hoping for them, they're still surprising when they actually happen, you know? And they're just the kinds of things that everyone talks about. It's a delight every single time to see my book covers as they get designed, and then to see them actually printed in a little box on my doorstep, and then to see them on a shelf in a bookstore. And that will never get old. And it's wonderful.
No, it won't. Yeah.
One of the things I like to tell people is becoming an author, you know, actually making it as a professional author is so much harder than you think it's going to be, but it is so much better than you think it's going to be. It's satisfying and it's thrilling and it's fun in ways that you know, you're hoping for, but then to actually see that it's true is just wonderful.
Mm-hmm. So I want to know, what's your favorite genre to write? Because, you know, I'm really familiar with your thriller, your horror, right? You know, I don't even know that horror is a genre anymore. But what do you love to write? What's your favorite?
I don't know if I can pick one. I really like writing the thrillers. I love them. John Cleaver is finishing up this year, book 6, which is the very last one, will come out in June. And I've already started on a new supernatural thriller series with a new character, totally different premise.
Oh, really?
And just love it. I love writing that kind of story. But, well, I love science fiction as well.
I'd love to hear how you plot them out. Do you go back and you plant the seeds? Like, do you write the ending first? All of that. Like, how do you actually formulate the story?
Well, I do a lot of different methods, but where it all starts is, you know, kind of picking through the file folder, which is usually just a mental file folder of ideas. You know, what have I been excited about for a long time and haven't been able to get to yet? Well, now's my time. Let's get to it. And so I'll go through, you know, I keep a file on my tablet of notes, you know, that I'm excited about. I have all of these ideas floating around. The current one that I'm working on, the new thriller, is actually kind of directly inspired by an old YA science fiction book called The Girl with the Silver Eyes.
No, I haven't.
It is a wonderful book.
What year? Do you know what year it came out?
I don't. I can look it up right now, though.
I can't
even remember the name of the author. But I was talking about this on Twitter a few weeks ago. Actually, it was months ago at this point, you know, talking about how much I loved it. And it turned out that there were all of these other people. Okay, the author's name is Willow Davis Roberts. And this book came out in... Click this link.
I've got it too. We're having a race.
It's a race.
Published January 1st, 91. That can't possibly be true. Oh, no. Okay. First published in 1980. That sounds better. Okay, so anyway... This is a great book that not a lot of people have heard of. Like I said, a few months ago, Jessica Day George and Shannon Hale and I were totally geeking out about how much we loved this book and how much it inspired us when we were in elementary school. And so I have always loved the premise, the idea that there's a group of kids with psychic powers. And so kind of basically ended up thinking, I'm going to do John Cleaver backwards. Where the serial killer, the monster that they're fighting, is a completely normal human being who's just, you know, a psycho. But then have the kid be psychic, have some supernatural powers. And so it's a reverse situation. And slowly find out, you know, oh, there are other kids like me. And, oh, we can work together. And so that's kind of the really quick premise for the new series. And that is a genre that I love to work in. And in terms of how I outline all of that, once I have that premise in mind, I start to, you know, drill down into the character. Who is he or she going to be? And, you know, in this case, they're psychic. What psychic powers? And what can those powers do? And what can those powers not do? And what are the crappy side effects of those powers?
Okay.
Because this one is a thriller, I look at the bad guy. You know, what is the mystery that they're trying to solve? And what are the steps that it's going to take to solve that? What are the clues that are going to be left behind? And how will the characters be able to interpret those clues to arrive at both correct and incorrect conclusions? And really kind of reverse engineering the whole story from the way that I want it to end.
Right. Good. So we're watching... What's the name of that show that we just completed?
The Leftovers.
The Leftovers. Okay. It's the same writer as Lost. So I didn't trust it at all, you know, but it was good enough that I just kept watching. And Michael goes, oh, this is Lost reversed. It's like, instead of, you know, everybody's gathered on an island from a plane crash, it's like, where did they all go? You know, they all disappeared. But, you know, what's interesting is... that they, it could be the opposite story and it's completely different. It's like you don't actually even see that, you know. And if we weren't, you know, completely deconstructing everything that we watch, we, you know, I'm not sure anybody else knows this. Yeah, spoiler. There you go. Yeah. But so you plot it out, you figure it out, you go backwards and reverse engineer.
Yes.
Okay.
I am a very extensive outliner. I don't like to start actually writing until I know more or less exactly where I'm going.
Okay.
You know, I need to know how the book is going to end. I need to know what arc the character is going to follow.
Okay.
And how they are going to change.
Good.
And I don't always follow my own outline. I will very often, in fact, I can't even remember a book that I didn't change drastically during the writing process, because I'll come to a point in the outline and say, oh, well, today I'm supposed to write a chapter where she does this, but it just doesn't feel right, and I'm going to do this instead.
Right, but
I'm going to reveal this clue four chapters early. I'm going to go off on this tangent because this other character is more interesting. Right. I will always have that freedom to change the outline, but I can't start until I have the outline, because that's how I plan the story in my head.
Yeah. That's,
well, if you have the structure first, then it's safe to go play. You know, I, on the other hand, I like to write seven chapters that I'm going to have to cut later. Just kidding.
Yeah.
I like
to describe it as a road trip.
Yeah.
You know,
what I really want to know too is, how do you write that darkness? How does your family deal with that? That's really more the question. How are you able to do that? Because, like, I so go there, and, you know, I pretty much have to tell my kids, yeah, if you want to tell me you love me, you better go write it on the whiteboard, because I might bite your head off.
I do sequester myself away from the family while writing, but despite what most people assume, at least for me, I don't really get kind of emotionally ruined by all of the emotionally awful books that I write, you know, writing John Cleaver, who is a sociopath and obsessed with death and always thinks about killing people. I don't know what this says about me or about him, but I can write him and not really feel affected by it. You know, there's one or two scenes in the series that were very hard to write and that I felt like I needed recovery time. But in general, one of the whole, you know, the premise of John Cleaver in many ways is that he is a normal person and that the thoughts that he has are the same thoughts we all have. He just entertains them longer than the rest of us do. And so I don't think that it's really icky. You know, I don't feel like I'm getting gross sociopath all over myself when I write it, because it's just a very normal thing. You know, we were talking about TV shows earlier. One of the ones that I love, that I just actually this morning finished the new season of, is Better Call Saul, which is a spinoff of Breaking Bad.
Yeah, we love Better Call Saul.
Both of those shows, Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, are about watching good people make bad decisions and ruin their lives.
Yeah.
And the reason that I love those shows is because every single bad decision is 100% understandable. Right. And you get to a point where you're cheering. You're like, yes, Jimmy McGill, I want you to succeed at this awful, criminal, unjustifiable thing that you're doing.
Well, it's about providing, you know, appropriate motivation. You know, and the circumstances that will call for a breaking with, you know,
exactly. And I think that most of us, while we tend to avoid those situations, I think we're pretty good at staying out of them. When we see another character in them, we immediately, oh yeah, he's doing what I would do, and I want him to succeed, even though I don't want him to succeed, and I know that it's wrong. Totally, I'm rooting for him to not get caught.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And John Cleaver, I think, is the same way. I love talking to readers who say, I was rooting for him and I wanted him to do it, even though I knew it was wrong. And that's one of the reasons I don't think that writing it is as hard as people assume. You know, it's not as taxing, it's not as draining as people tend to assume it's going to be. Because that's just how we all think. That's how we all are.
Right. We're all just looking for good enough justification.
Yeah.
You know, to do the thing that is socially inappropriate.
Exactly. And that makes us all sound like terrible people. But no, but I think it's just a very human thing.
Yeah. I think for me, the reason it is because I write nonfiction. So I'm actually writing about things that have happened.
Yeah, they're physically taking place.
Yeah. So I'm actually, you know,
interviewing the murderer in prison and things like that,
right,
scare me to death.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons with this new thriller that I wanted to make sure the bad guy in it was a totally normal human, no supernatural, just a plain old serial killer, because that's a lot scarier. I think it's much scarier. We don't have that level of irreality to separate ourselves and say, well, it's okay that he's killing people because he's a monster. Right. No, he's not. He's just a dude.
So a friend of mine in high school was abducted and killed by the freeway killer. They found his remains finally a few years ago. I grew up in Southern California. And so I just recently read this book about this guy. What's his name, Michael? It's on my nightstand. Here's the thing. Like, I study serial killers, right? And the thing is that is most terrifying is how normal they are. How charming. Yeah. Charming.
Yeah, they've all got great communication skills for the most part. Right. They're very charming and very normal seeming. So,
and I knew Anne Rule, and she once told me that the girls that got away were the ones that trusted their gut, but just how completely personable. What's his name?
I don't like to go that deep with this kind of stuff. She's like, oh, let's watch this documentary on a serial killer. I'm like, no, I'm going to go watch
Ted Bundy.
Something else.
Ted Bundy was that one. And I can't remember the other one's name.
So the Partials series, was that YA?
Yes. Partials was young adult. And the new one, Mirador, is also young adult.
Okay. And what was the difference between writing for adults versus writing for young adults?
Well,
or was there?
There are differences, yeah. But they're not the differences that I think people expect. First mm-hmm. of all, the awful truth behind it is that I'm never actually writing for an audience other than myself.
Mm.
You know, I am writing what I think is cool, and I'm doing it in a way that I think is exciting, which is why I jump around from thriller to science fiction to dystopia and all these different genres. And so as I write, I'm not necessarily thinking, oh man, teens are going to love this.
Mm.
Because I'm not writing for teens, I'm writing for myself. And if people like it, then that's awesome. In that sense, there's not a lot of difference. You know, I don't feel like you need to change the way that the characters talk or the way that the characters think. I mean, you the one thing you can never do, the absolute death sentence for young adult fiction is to talk down to it,
right.
To dumb it down,
mm-hmm.
you know, to think for even a second that it has to be less sophisticated.
Right.
It can't be. It has to be, if anything, more sophisticated because you're dealing with an audience that kind of spends their entire life not trusting adults. So you have to do it right. You have to give them a real story with real characters that really work, because mm-hmm. if you don't, they're going to know. So I guess the one rule that I have that makes something YA instead of adult is basically just the problems need to be solved by children in ways that are believable for children to solve them.
Mm.
And once I do that, then no holds are barred. You know, the books can be whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
Extreme Makeover is adult fiction because the story that I was trying to tell necessarily involved adults in it.
Mm-hmm.
Blue Screen is, you know, it deals with a lot of the same things. It has a lot of the same science fiction. It has just as much, if not more, actual science and kind of hard-edged knowledge in it. But the problems are solved by teenagers, and so it's young adult.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to say this. It's Angel of Darkness, the true story of Randy Kraft. That's the, yeah, that's what I was trying to come
there
up with.
There we go. Randy Kraft.
Yeah.
That's the name. I couldn't even told you that name if I had to come up with it. But anyway, cool. Well,
that's great.
The other thing that I want to make sure we talk about is actually the Writing Excuses Cruise.
The podcast
that I do has gotten big enough over the years that this will be the fifth year now that we are doing our own writing conference. And for the past 2 years, it's been on a cruise ship.
Cool.
And so, you know, at this point, it is too late for any of your listeners to sign up. But for the future, we do this every summer. We get together for a week, and we have a bunch of guest authors who are all incredible and amazing. And we sit on a cruise ship, and we eat fancy food, and we go cool places, and we write, and we talk about writing. And it's a lot of fun. People learn a lot. So...
Oh, that's great.
That's one of my favorite things that I do all year.
Yeah, that would be.
What's the name of that? Where can we find out about it?
It is called the Writing Excuses Retreat or the Out of Excuses Retreat.
Okay.
We kind of use the terms interchangeably. The official name is it's called the Out of Excuses Writing Retreat. But
yeah, and is there a website associated with that, or can they go to your website?
Just the plain old Writing Excuses website, writingexcuses.com.
Mm-hmm.
That's got it. The best way to find it is to Google it and look for the retreat.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm doing right now and have to finish up in the next couple of weeks is we offer 4 scholarships. It's a week-long writing retreat, and those are not cheap.
Yeah.
Ours is one of the cheapest, but it's still, you know, a couple $1,000 once you factor in all of the airfare and stuff that you need to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we offer 4 scholarships that are full ride for people who can't afford it on their own. And that's one of my projects is to manage the scholarship. So I'm right now kind of narrowing it down and choosing the last few who'll get it. And I've got great people that I work with. 2 of the scholarships are adjudicated by the Carl Brandon Society, which is for writers of color in the science fiction and fantasy market. And so they pick 2 of them for us, and then retreat alumni and I pick the other 2. So it's a really great group, and we're kind of going out of our way to make sure that we get people who wouldn't have the opportunity through any other means. It's a lot of work, and it's my favorite and least favorite thing I do all year. I love being able to call someone and say, hey, guess what, you get to come on the cruise with us, and that's wonderful. But then, you know, there's the 74 other people.
Yeah, it's like writing rejection letters.
Yeah. And they're all fantastic, too. We have them submit writing samples, and some of these authors are just really great and going places, and I wish we could help more of them. But for now, four is the best we can do.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your contribution to the writing world with your podcast and your writing, and certainly thank you for this interview. What's the best way that people can follow you, be in contact with you? What's your website? What's your social media handles?
Okay, the thing to remember is the Dan Wells. Okay?
The Dan Wells.
Because there's another Dan Wells that got to everything first. So I am the Dan Wells.
Yeah.
So that's my Twitter. That is Facebook. That is my website, thedanwells.com. It is the easiest way to find me everywhere.
Excellent.
So,
and you're usually in some kind of your headshot. You're usually in a wig of some kind or a hat or something. So if you're looking for the Dan Wells, you know, you arrived
right
if he's got something going on.
It's a big white powdered wig.
Yeah.
With
yeah.
a crown.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Dan. We have certainly learned.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Our pleasure.
If you like the show, shoot us some stars. It's all about the stars, baby. And be sure to share the Calliope Writing Coach podcast with your writer friends. You can find more episodes at calliopepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.
I know, right?
I know, right?
I know, right?